Welcome to another exciting interview on Kung Fu Conversations. Owen and I are both honored and thrilled today to talk to our mutual friend, Sifu Alex Richter, the Kung Fu genius with a bunch of different handles. He is a teacher online. He is a Wing Chun expert. I'm going to give you a title there, Sifu. I hope you don't mind. He is an author. Just you name it, he does it. He also has a fantastic podcast, the KFG, the Kung Fu Genius Podcast. And he's here to talk to us today about Wing Chun, martial arts, teaching, maybe some Bruce Lee. And we'll talk about his podcast as well. So Sifu, Alex, thank you so much for joining us today.
Yes, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me. Thank you guys so much for having me. I was under the idea that we were going to talk about my knowledge of fine wines. I had no idea we were going to talk about martial arts and kung fu.
So do you prefer European wine, or are you more of a South American kind of guy? Australia?
No.
We talk? Germany?
I'm actually totally joking. I don't know anything about wines. I barely drink any alcohol. So anyway, it's probably a good idea to actually talk about kung fu, I suppose.
Let's start there. So our audience is what I would call an eclectic blend. We mainly focus on Chinese martial arts, but thank goodness for our last interview, Sifu David Peterson was so kind to introduce our audience to Wing Chun. So we're getting some Chunners, as they've been called, into the fold here. So for our Choi Li Foot, our Hunga, for our Chen Tai Chi, I got a few Western boxers and a few Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu cats that watch and listen to the show. If you would be so kind for those folks, give us a small introduction on your origin story and how you've got to current 2024 Sifu Alex Richter. Did I add extra 20 in there? I think I did. So we just went to the future. So if you would give us a little bit of your origin story, I know you've told it before, but it would be great to hear it again, my friend.
So I suppose I started, like a lot of kids, in the 1980s, being inspired by the Karate Kid. In the early to mid 80s, I was bullied by a neighbor and decided to start taking karate, very much in line with the Karate Kid theme, and became absolutely fascinated with martial arts. I started at age 8, about a year after I started learning karate, which was really Tang Sudo, but back in those days, a lot of the more rare styles, they didn't really have the courage to just say that it was Tang Sudo or this style. It was always just karate, right? And then you would learn afterwards that you were actually doing Tang Sudo or something like that. And then I started with that. And about a year later, my dad brought me Enter the Dragon. I was sick from school. I stayed home and my dad went to the video store, if people even know what those things are nowadays. And he got me Enter the Dragon. And when I saw Enter the Dragon, I was like, oh my God, this is what I want to do. And that kind of started me on a whole Bruce Lee kick. And very shortly after that, you know, in the 80s, especially on the East Coast, they used to show kung fu movies every Saturday on something called Black Belt Theater. And so you would see all these old Shaw films. And the second movie that I saw after Bruce Lee's Enter the Dragon was a Lau Kar Leung directed kung fu movie called Heroes of the East with Yasuaki Kurata. Basically, it is a martial arts porn of kung fu versus Japanese styles. And when I saw that and I saw the breadth of Chinese styles and Japanese styles and the weapons, I was like, oh my God, this is pretty much all I ever want to think about. And that kind of got me started into a fascination with martial arts in general, and Chinese martial arts in particular. I eventually got my black belt in Taekwondo when I was about 15. At that point, we had already relocated from the East Coast to Seattle. And as many people know, Seattle's where Bruce Lee got his start teaching Wing Chun. So there are a number of schools out there in the Seattle area that basically teaches pre-Jeet Kune Do era stuff, I suppose, right? It's not quite Wing Chun, not quite Jeet Kune Do yet. And so I started training in that. So as a Bruce Lee fan, to actually learn a Bruce Lee variation of Wing Chun was really huge for me. And that started me on a path which eventually brought me to, you know, trying out kickboxing and grappling and this, that, and the other thing. And then I eventually got fascinated with learning Wing Chun, and I shipped myself off to the Trainer Academy for the EWTO at that time, which was a castle, Langenzell Castle in Germany, where I did nothing but train Wing Chun 5 days a week, 6 hours a day under the top masters at that time. Around 2002, I came back to the East Coast to New York City, opened my school, and for the next 9 years, I trained directly with the WT Grandmaster Sifu Leung-Ting and Sifu Carson Lau, among others. I left Sifu Leung-Ting's organization in 2011. I've been independent since then. I got in a spat with my former teacher, Sifu Leung-Ting, in the press in the around 2016. And that spawned the title, The Kung Fu Genius, which I use purely ironically. I don't consider myself a Kung Fu genius by any stretch of the imagination. I know people like Sifu David Peterson, like Sifu Mak Chi Kong, who are far more knowledgeable and far more skilled than myself. So I use it in only the strictest of ironies and sarcasm. But it has become a thing. The KFG has become a brand. Kung Fu Genius has become a thing. I started a podcast with my late friend, Big Sean Madigan. I don't remember the exact year. Maybe it was 2016, 17. I'm not sure. And we did that for a few years, which was great. He was the Jeet Kune Do guy. I was the Wing Chun guy. I smell a sitcom there somewhere. And and it was great. People really took to it. I got a little bit of a cult following. And then, as many people know, unfortunately, Big Sean passed very untimely. And I didn't want to continue Dudes of Kung Fu without him, because Dudes of Kung Fu was Big Sean and I. It wasn't me. So I decided to do my own podcast with a slightly different tone. And that's been the Kung Fu Genius podcast, which we're now in our fourth season, our fourth year. And, yeah, it's a lot of fun.
You know, I actually found you guys, the Dudes of Kung Fu, that is, and it was during COVID, which was very surreal for everybody all across the world. I can tell you, you know, my 9-to-5 job, Sifu, is, being your friendly Kung Fu bus driver here in Boulder. And I remember, I had a route that went through a working class neighborhood, and I would usually pick up 65 to 70 people. I mean, standing room only. People are riding in the bus like it's Calcutta or something. And then I went there the next day when the whole COVID protocol started going down, and I had one person in an 8-hour shift. And so, yeah, it was insane. So when I went to my summer bid line, because it's spring, summer, fall, I did something that was a split shift. And I call it the Baywatch bus. When a bus breaks down, I take my bus out there. And so we had a bunch of people quit. It was only 40-hour weeks. There was no overtime because we weren't sure how long COVID was going to last, things like that. And so I got free training time. I got paid to train in the bus all by myself. And I started listening to podcasts, and it was you and Big Sean. And that chemistry that you two fellas had, whether it was lovingly busting each other's balls or getting really serious about a topic. Now, yep. I'm going to interject here because I wanted to talk to you about this. I know you've said on your show that you haven't been able to quite listen to the show again. Have you ever thought about talking to some of the guys over there and maybe doing a greatest hits of the Dudes of Kung
Fu? Yeah, I mean, I actually wanted to write a book where it kind of recaps some of our best stuff, but I actually talked about that shortly after Big Sean passed, but I still have a really hard time. I have a hard time talking about him. I have a hard time writing about him, and I have not listened to one single episode since he passed away. I can't. Because even the last episode that we had, we recorded that, and then he passed away before that episode came out. And then I edited the video and I put it on YouTube. And that was probably the most gut-wrenchingly difficult thing I had ever done in my entire life. And I still can't, man. Even now I feel a little teary-eyed thinking about it. So I don't know. It'll probably be a little while before I can do that, but people still tell me they listen to it, and some people have just found it, you know, because they found my podcast and then they've kind of retroactively found the other one. And I'm glad people like it. I still think every now and again he's going to give me a call, or he's going to send me a text, or he's going to go like, "Oh my God, did you see what this guy said? Like, can you believe this?" And then we would go and have some kind of rant. What I really lament is that we would record the thing, you know, we would record it over like Google Meet or something like that. And it wasn't a video format podcast like KFG is. It's just audio. And after we would finish recording, we would kind of just catch up with each other, because we recorded most weeks, not every week. and we would kind of catch up and talk. And then we would get into stuff that we wouldn't talk about on the podcast because maybe it's a little political or maybe it's some stuff that's a little personal about certain sifus or whatever. And I really wish that we had kept the record button on because there would have been an entire like corpus of conversations, which are like the dudes of Kung Fu after hours. And yeah. Some of those conversations we had were some of the most insightful conversations I ever had about martial arts, but the record button wasn't on. And that's also where Big Sean told me the story of what he said to Wong Jack Man on the phone, which he would refuse to tell the story on the podcast. But after he passed away, I said, the story is too good for me not to tell it, where he basically did what every Bruce Lee fan always wanted to do, was tell Wong Jack Man off personally on the phone. And it was great. But that was like after the main episode, that's when we would talk about these things. And we would go back and forth. And he was, you know, he would also ask me a lot of questions about Wing Chun because he was a JKD guy, but he wanted to know more about Yip Man Wing Chun, and he had an absolute fascinating brain for JKD and martial arts and boxing and breaking down fighters and it was great. It was really great. So I still can't bring myself to listen to an episode though. Yeah.
I get it. But let me thank you personally for you keeping them out there because they are gems. They are treasures. And so we're going to talk about your podcast, The Kung Fu Genius, a little later. But to our audience out there that is not familiar with it, please go back and check out the Dudes of Kung Fu with the former late great Big Sean Madigan. So you have a very unique story in that not only did you learn Wing Chun in a European German castle, which is badass to say. By the way, I'm going to have to find out what episode, but one of my favorite stories you were talking about was the guy with the pubic hair on his face and the other
on his head. Yes.
On his head. And that one is near and dear to me. But, in all seriousness, you also spent a lot of time in Hong Kong. How long were you in Hong Kong? You said it was about a 6-year period that you would go back and forth. And I know you've said it on your show. But could you tell our audience a little bit of difference, because it's the same lineage, but maybe a different focus or a different emphasis on what you learned in the castle as opposed to what was taught in Hong Kong for Wing Chun? Could you talk a little bit about that, Sifu?
Sure. Well, I never lived in Hong Kong. I went to Hong Kong quite regularly after I opened my school, City Wing Chun, in New York City. I established my school in 2002. In the first few years when you're running your own school, it's a lot of lean years in terms of food and money and all that kind of stuff. So it wasn't until about, I want to say 2007, 2008. So my school, was for about 5 or 6 years. I started to get some students. I started to earn a little bit of money that I started to take some trips to do extra training in Wing Chun at the headquarters with Siva Leung-Ting and his guys over there. However, in that 5 to 6 year period, as I was building that up, Siva Leung-Ting would come to my school on many years, 1 to 2 times a year for week-long seminars. I would go to the other stops in Boston or Texas or whatever. And then Siva Carson Lau, another fantastic mentor of mine from Hong Kong, would also come to my school twice a year. So I was getting a lot of Hong Kong-based WG training in those years before I started actually going to Hong Kong a little more regularly. And I would go a couple times a year. There was one year I even went 4 times a year to Hong Kong. Thank God for tax write-offs. A trip to Hong Kong for me is a business expense, right?
Yeah.
So I could, charge that to the business because I'm going there really to further my own education. So, I had been to Hong Kong a few times before, before I started WT and as I began, but I was just there for vacation. And then it was like, I think about my 4th or 5th trip to Hong Kong where I started actually training with the guys over there. So there is I suppose the big elephant in the room with Leung-Ting's Wing Chun is that you have, it's one of the biggest, international Kung Fu associations, I suppose. I don't know if it's still the biggest. At one time, it certainly was the biggest. And the EWGO, the European Wing Chun Organization, their focus, was usually more on the self-defense front. Yes, of course, you learn the forms of the Danchi and the Chisao and all the stuff you would learn in the so-called traditional or more classical representation of the system. But there was a very strong focus on, you know, learning how to really use this stuff against the types of attacks that would happen to you on the street, which are not necessarily an opponent attacking you with Pak Sao punch or your opponent doing some kind of Wing Chun based thing towards you and having the coolest way to defend Pak Sao against your would-be assailants. But it was, you know, people pushing you and putting you in headlocks and trying to take you down. And how do you defend against that stuff using all this great technology we have in Wing Chun? And as a result, that tends to be the focus of a lot of European Wing Chun instructors, that they come from a very self-defense frame. And while, of course, self-defense and practical fighting is absolutely what we're doing in Wing Chun, if you don't have a strong connection to Chinese culture and to why certain things are done in a traditional Chinese martial art, which might not make sense for Westerners, it's difficult to understand everything that Wing Chun has to offer if you look at it purely through the lens of Western pragmatism. So when I started learning from Sifu Leung Ting, the emphasis was a lot more on improving your Wing Chun skills because this is your Kung Fu and you have to do it well because that is what it means to be good at Wing Chun. And if your Kung Fu is developed to a high level degree, of course you can defend yourself. Of course you can fight, rather than going like, we're going to focus on a more technical self-defense way of using Wing Chun. The Chinese ways to build you from the inside out. And so, on top of that, there was a big technical divergence between the two programs, that sometimes gets a little political between like the European guys and the Hong Kong guys. And I have really good relationships with both sides. But there were pretty vast, differences from a technical perspective. The Latsao and Gaosao and the Chisao sparring methods, were a big part of how you train in the Hong Kong methodology to make sure you could do this stuff under duress and stress. And it wasn't just about the Chi Sao being flowy or just purely about feeling, but it was also like when the dude is hammering away, can you stop this person from murdering your face with punches and elbows? And so the Hong Kong system of Leung Ting's Wing Chun, you know, is very pragmatic and very modern, but it does it in a very different way from the European side of things. And my job has kind of been rectifying the two and kind of taking the best of European pragmatic teaching methods and step-by-step methodology with the best of what the Chinese do and how they teach it. And that's kind of been my goal in the last few years, is to kind of marry the two.
Would you say in that marrying process, could you, you know, let's say I moved to New York and start training, because I only got a small window though. We can talk about that later too. But let's say I choose to go to New York and start training with Sifu Alex Richter, the Kung Fu genius at City Wing Chun. What would my first 2 weeks, 4 months, a year look like? What is the foundation? How do you stack the student and build them from the ground up, Sifu, in your method?
So what we do is we still teach the traditional program, I suppose, in the canonical order you would learn the forms. So the only difference is that alongside learning the traditional skills, for example, learning the first form and learning the basic footworks and turning and basic hand techniques and single arm chi sao, parallel to that, we have sparring exercises right from the beginning to get the students acclimated with the kind of attacks that are going to happen on the street, the kind of situations that they're going to run themselves into, I should say. Of course, in a really traditional way, if a student was not pressed for time, and you just taught them in a really traditional way, just teach them the form, let them get really good at that, maybe have them hit the wall bag, develop their low elbow power, do the basics of footwork, turning, single arm chi sao, and not much else. Even though that's kind of a slow way and it would require a very dedicated student, it's actually the fastest way to teach, because their foundation will be so strong that once they have that foundation, you could then teach them all the fighting stuff on the back end much more quickly because they have a good stance, a good turn, a good advancing step, strong low elbow power, an idea of the structure. The problem is that the modern student is not necessarily going to invest in the time it takes to get really good at these things in an abstract way before they start seeing palpable results today. So what we do is the modern way, at least the way I see it, is to teach it on a parallel track. While the students are learning the traditional skills, which takes some time, the form, the basic footwork. And by footwork, I mean to do it in a really perfect classical way, the turning and the step and the posture, everything you would expect from proper classical orthodox Wing Chun. But at the same time, okay, if I fire a punch, like, can you do something? Or are you just going to stand in this Unum Tao stance and eat a punch to the face? So we make sure that they kind of learn how to close the gap, how to be very proactive, how to use a swarming methodology with close body tactics to get with inside the powerful strikes of an opponent. So we're doing some behavior modification rather than standing there and trying to block punches, close the gap, very similar to the way a grappler would close the gap to avoid eating punches and kicks at distance. But instead, we're doing it with a Wing Chun framework and a lot of chain punches. Now, chain punches sometimes get a bad rap for being a bit overused in Wing Chun. But for beginners who don't have a Qi Xiao foundation, they cannot react in a flexible way. It's a stopgap measure. Hey, just go forward and start blasting. It's not the best we have in Wing Chun. It's not all we have in Wing Chun. But given the limited skill set of a beginner, it's a stopgap measure while we then develop other skills. And so I teach the sparring in all the sparring that a student would do at first, which is they're still sparring drills. It's not just like free sparring. And the reason why it's not free sparring at first is because until a student feels comfortable with a certain movement base, if you put them into the fire right away, they're either going to freak out, get scared, and not want to do that anymore, or they're going to develop a lot of bad reactions. Or if they have previous martial arts training, they're just going to jump back to what they did before. And I don't want a student to come to my school to learn how to use Wing Chun only to get so freaked out that he or she starts resorting to their previous karate training. And that's no diss against karate. It's just, well, if you come to my school, I want you to learn what I have to teach. So the sparring drills that we do are always like this. The opponent, the bad guy, is a non-Wing Chun person. And the Wing Chun person is the Wing Chun defender, right? So what we do is we teach the student how to defend straight punches, crosses, swings, low punches, and straight kick, round kick, all like the kind of classic types of strikes that could come at them, even some wild stuff like over the top. And when they feel confident being able to defend those from distance, closing the gap without running into punches, then we do add-ons. And add-ons are based on the common human behaviors that happen on the street. We're not talking about high-level martial artists. We're not talking about dealing with a high-level Brazilian jiu-jitsu guy or a high-level boxer. We're talking about if you have to defend yourself on the street and you go in and you do not knock the guy down or back or discourage them from fighting with your punches and the fight drags on, what are the common things that people do? Well, there's about five, all right? The first one, some people, when they get hit, they run away. They back away. They try to get away from your chain punches. So we need to teach the students to defend against what we call the runner, or colloquially the Wong Jack man. So we teach the students how to use aggressive forward steps and not let that guy get space on you. So to swarm that guy. But then what else happens? The second add-on is the guy could do the opposite. He could get punched in the face and then press forward. Some people get hit, they cower. Some people get hit and they drive forward. So we have to teach a student what happens if you go and punch someone and the guy just goes forward and eats your punches and swarms you. So you're going to have to convert to elbow strikes and offlining to make sure you don't get run over with chain punches, right? If I see one more video of some Wing Chun idiot chain punching some guy bigger and stronger who's running through them and they're still doing all these weak chain punches while getting run over, for me, it's like the guy playing the violin on the Titanic, right? It's like at some point, jump in the lifeboat, do something else, right? So we teach the students the runner, the presser. What else happens on the street? Headlock. It's not a very advanced type of clinch, but people get hit. People grab in headlocks and start wailing on the head. So the students from day one need to develop a very solid headlock defense because it happens on the street much more than Pak Da, much more than a Wing Chun maneuver they're going to run into. What is the other add-on? Chain punch stoppers. Sometimes you go in chain punching, especially as a beginner, your opponent may just grab onto your forearms and try to keep you at distance and keep you from punching them. So the students need to have a protocol to deal with that, because that's extremely high percentage. And then finally, the tackle. Now, we're not talking about a high-level wrestling takedown or chaining Brazilian jiu-jitsu single leg into double leg into ankle pick or whatever. We're just talking about frat boy tackle, because these are the things that happen when people eat a couple punches and then they try to save themselves, headlock swarming, all this kind of stuff. So the sparring is an opener. The bad guy is going to open with a straight punch, a swing, a kick, whatever. And when the Wing Chun trainee comes in, the bad guy is going to choose one of these five add-ons. They're going to try to run away. And then maybe the next time they fire a punch and press, next time they fire a punch, they go for a tackle. Next time headlock and chain punch stopper. And then they start mixing these things. So we give the bad guy options. It's a script, but it's a script that can be variated so that the trainees learns right from the start to defend against stuff that's going to happen. If it's Wing Chun versus Wing Chun, both partners are just going to try to shut each other down with really bad, sloppy Wing Chun, but no one's going to learn that the guy on the street is not going to try to pak sao you or bong sao you. And so that's why we don't focus, as some traditional Wing Chun schools do, with a lot of Wing Chun v Wing Chun stuff at first. When they start learning Chi Sao later, then we can show them, okay, this is how you defend Pak Da from different angles and Quan Sao and Fak Sao and all this stuff. All the cool, fun chess game of Wing Chun. They can do that when they start double arm Chi Sao. But in the foundational training at the Siunam Tao level, they should be focusing on how to defend against practical attacks on the street. And that's what we would do at that Siunam Tao level for the first few months or whatever that someone's training at our school.
That's fantastic. And thank you for sharing
that's good stuff. Yeah.
Sure. My pleasure.
I like that. Do you have that ability too? It seems like you can dial up or dial down, on that student. How much force, little Johnny over there has only been here for 2 or 3 weeks. Yeah, the intensity. Or, but Susie's been here for 5 years and she can take it from the best of them. So you crank it up for Susie, you might dial it down for little Johnny and work on that individual student, what they need. Yeah. I love that.
Scalable, and as the student learns, they first learn the runner, then they learn the presser, then they learn this one, this. And then when they have all five, then we mix two of the five, then three of the five, then four of the five, then all of the five. So we do it all in this very scaled up way. So when the students are practicing, I might tell one of the students, hey, so-and-so is new. So after you come in with that straight punch, just focus on the runner for now. Don't worry about that other stuff. And then as they come in, then we start to add them more and more until they can do it. And the intensity, we have an 80-20 rule at City Wing Chun. It's not the Pareto principle. It's not the money 80-20 rule. It is the intensity 80-20 rule. And that is, if the students get attacked 10 times by their partner who's playing the bad guy, they should be successful, or I should say, do it in as clean of a way, in as technical a way, in as safe of a way as possible, at least 80% of the time. So that would mean like maybe 2 out of 10 times, maybe the punch could have slipped in if it was a real thing, or maybe the punch lands with controlled force and I would have walked into that one. Because what that means is that there's still a very small chance that the guy is going to hit you, which means it's not totally throwing softballs at you. You still need to make sure that you're kind of watching it, right? And if a student, let's say, eats a low punch or a straight punch 5 out of 10 times, then that current level of intensity is too much for them. And we dial it until they're successful at least 80% of the time. And that they maybe only mess up or have a small mistake or something that's not quite right 20% of the time. And as they get better, the intensity increases, but we still keep this 80-20 rule. So there's still a little bit of a risk, for lack of a better word, that, yeah, you might eat this punch, right? Even though it's very safe with equipment and everything. But that one would have gone in. So we still need to keep it realistic. It's not especially my senior students, if you're stopping every single punch perfectly with no mistakes, you need to tell your partner to try a little harder. so that's kind of how we do it, especially in the Wing Chun versus non-Wing Chun sparring protocol.
Mm-hmm. Awesome. That's awesome. I think I'm going to come back and ask you a little bit more, not so much about that, but I guess I can do it now. Why not? Let's just keep on topic.
Go for it.
Sure.
So I love you're talking about marrying the two, the European and the Liang Ting from Hong Kong system, because it's all Liang Ting, Wing Chun. Mm-hmm. But is there something that you feel over the years that you'd be willing to share this? If you don't, I can just move on to the next topic. Is there something out of that that you feel is, that's Sifu Alex? I can hang my hat on that and say, yeah, I've come from here, but this is what I've worked on, and this is uniquely me in my teaching of my students. What would you say to that, Sifu? Or can you think of something like
that? That training protocol that I just came up with, where we have kind of a bad guy and then the other person is Wing Chun, that started obviously in the European system, which is so based on self-defense. But that's not exactly how they do it either. I can't claim credit for it. However, I always consider myself perhaps the average intelligence, Forrest Gump with average intelligence of Wing Chun. So I've had a tremendous luck to always be around people who are like much better, much more knowledgeable than me, to somehow have an in directly with Sifu Liang Ting or Sifu Kanchbek or any of these guys who are kind of high up. I'm always like somehow the idiot that ends up in the room, and I get to benefit from a lot of experience. And so a lot of what I do is I synthesize what I've gotten from different people. Maybe the way it's synthesized is uniquely mine, but I can tell you, if we break everything down, I'd be like, yeah, but this I got from this guy, this I got from this guy. And I think it's the presentation I do that's unique. For example, I actually took something from Gracie Jiu-Jitsu. All right. Many years ago, I trained at Henner Gracie school. Henner's brother, the other one. Man, why am I drawing a blank?
We can come back to it. You were at a Gracie school, right?
It's called Age Related Decline. So I was training at their Beverly Hills school. And when I joined there, I was just there for like a month, so I was doing some training. What I liked is they had a very strong focus on self-defense rather than teaching what a lot of Brazilian jiu-jitsu schools do at first, which is sport jiu-jitsu, just learning all the chokes and everything and all the arm locks and stuff. Their blue belt program is your opponent is trying to wail on you like what would happen on the street. How do you clinch? How do you bring them down? How do you neutralize a dangerous situation? And I liked that because that was very much in line with how I had already been doing things. But they did a couple of things that I thought were could be very beneficial for Wing Chun people, is that they had the program written out on a card. And so you would join there and their entire, let's say, blue belt program is written on a card. And as you join, you do lesson one, it gets checked off, lesson two, and then you can see exactly what you learned and what you did not learn. And when you had done all these lessons, you could get like your stripe and stuff. So it tied in with the ranking system, which is fine, but it became a record of what you learned and what you had not learned. And I realized this was a problem in Wing Chun, because when you look outside of the standard exercises that almost all Wing Chun people can agree upon, right? Single arm chi sao, poon sao, the lop dao drill, stuff like that. There's so many other things in there. Pak da, and this defense and this way of doing it and putting this thing with this thing, that even though there was a basic framework in Liang Ting Wing Chun, it's very easy for an instructor that likes a certain group of techniques to maybe de-emphasize certain other things that may be very helpful for students, even if they don't use it themselves. Yes. And so I thought, well, if the program isn't standardized, then the students don't get the full breadth of the program and they only get the instructor's edits. Now, it's okay that the instructor has their own edits, because that means that they're a living, breathing martial artist that's capable of making a thought for their own. But the student that is learning from them may benefit from a piece of the curriculum that they themselves may not find as useful as others. But if the instructor is only going to teach their favorite ideas or their best hits or the things that they're good at, then the next generation suffers from idea shrinkage. And then they're then passing on that based on an impartial picture of the totality, right? So this is the thing I would say, even though I stole it from the Gracies, but I was the first guy to do it in Wing Chun, is I wrote down the WT program I broke it down into lesson format from lesson one, and I have it all the way through the long pole, all the way through the double knives. How you do the chigurh and wooden dummy and everything, so that when I have a student at my school, when they go to the regular class, the instructor checks off their card. And if they did a private lesson with me, I would grab their card and I would see what they had learned. It doesn't mean that they've mastered it. I just know, okay, they've learned this thing from the dummy, this thing from the dummy. And I could say, okay, do you want to review this stuff you did, or do you want to keep going on in the lessons, right? So it allows me to really know, especially with students that I might not see regularly, where they are at, and to assess if they have learned everything in a certain program, right? We never learn everything, right? But if they learn all the lessons in a certain program, but they were still weak on certain things, then I could go, okay, so in the lesson plan, we maybe need to emphasize this thing a little bit more, because even though they're learning it, they're not very good at it. So it allows me to refine the curriculum year by year. We make little edits every year [S2] Awesome. [S1] for the group classes to make sure that the group classes are not geared for fanatics like you and me. They're geared for the person who comes twice a week. They have a regular job. They just kind of show up. So I've geared the group classes to be optimized for someone who comes twice a week and doesn't spend all of their time thinking about this. They come in, they got to get some power training so that they feel they can hit and kick with some power. They also need to feel like they can maybe do something if someone fires a punch at them. They need to feel like they're getting some kind of steady progress by, you know, little markers here and there to show that they're learning something. And it needs to be something that's digestible. For my hardcore guys, that's never a problem. Too many Wing Chun Sifus cater their curriculum and their teaching to the hardcore types. And the hardcore types are the easiest to teach. They're going to be there every class. They're going to be doing extra training. They're going to be asking better questions. They're going to be there every time you got something going on. You don't need to do anything extra for them except make sure they got good training. But the question is, the person or the people I feel that are most underserved, not just in Wing Chun, but in martial arts in general, is the average person who is not a total martial arts fanatic, but their life needs martial arts for them to have a modicum of sanity in their lives.
Jesus, and, that's well and, said. And, that is well said. And, keep going, Super.
And we live in our own echo chambers. Like, if you came with me to Hong Kong and saw the people that I hang out with, it's all high level kung fu people. And it's all just talking about the geekiest minutia about kung fu. But I'm under no illusion that that is the mentality of the average person who walks into my school. So I have to be able to separate like my martial arts geekdom from the service that I provide, which is in New York for people who work at a job. People come to me, they're 8 hours at a job that they hate.
Yeah.
So that hour 15 minutes they come for the training, it needs to be like a little oasis in the middle of the city. That's why at my school I have these bamboo curtains, not to make it look Chinese-y to use a Dre term. But because when they're inside my school, because we're up on the fifth floor, and they look out the window, I don't want them to see the skyscrapers across the street. I want them to feel that they are somewhere else because their whole life is being in this stressful city. When they are training with other people, I want them to feel like they're having a good time. It's a sense of community. It's a third place. I want them to feel that this is something that challenges them without overwhelming them. And it's a place that they want to come to. Now, my hardcore guys who really want to, like, you know, lace up and do all the sparring, I have the additional classes for those people. So the regular classes for the everyman, and then we have instructor classes, we have fighter classes, people want extra chi sao training, we have a chi sao classes, but I don't force the regular student to go to those classes. They're there for the hardcore types, but the average person should feel welcomed and comfortable in the school. And I don't judge my ability to teach based on what the average person does. You come in, average person is maybe doesn't have the cleanest bong sao or the cleanest techniques or whatever, but they love it and they leave and they have a smile on their face and they're sweating. And that is much more of a service to the community than just teaching the hardcore guy, the guy who comes into your school already hardcore and into it. And you just teach that guy how to fight with your moves. That guy was already a fighter when you came in. The person who hates his job doesn't have the confidence to ask his boss or her boss for a raise. the woman who just got out of an abusive relationship and wants to feel more confident, the adult who wasn't allowed to do martial arts because their parents were like ultra religious and wouldn't let them do that. Yep. And this is something to fulfill a childhood dream and nothing else. They don't care if they can beat someone up. So I can't, as I did in my early years, think that everyone who comes to me wants to be the best in Wing Chun, wants to be a fighter, because they are there for their own reasons. I give them something really cool to improve their lives. And the reason why they come is their own. And if their reasons align with mine, I have stuff for those guys because that's what I love to do, but it doesn't have to. They don't have to be like me. I don't, the way I talk about all this stuff in detail, like sometimes on the podcast or the details in the history, that's not me teaching a beginner class. Me teaching beginner class, I'm like a super positive gym coach. All right, guys, let's move. Awesome. Hey, good work. All right, let's turn a little bit. All right, let's go a little strong. Good, 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 good work. All right, awesome. Now I'm going to come at you a little bit deeper. So I want you to turn a little bit more when I come in. Awesome job. High five. Cool. Like that's how I teach beginners. My senior guys who are more hardcore, then I become a little more like a cranky Sifu because they can handle it because they want that. But I don't give that to someone who just came in off the street. We handle them with kid gloves so that they're happy and they feel safe.
Yeah. One of my favorite things about listening to your show, even though it's funny and quirky with your wingmen, and we'll get into those guys a little bit, but I honestly feel like your show is one of the adult voices out there that talks about these things and something that you've shared with your audience that I absolutely loved. And you mentioned it briefly if you want to elaborate on it, but I loved how you said it was, I didn't think this way 10 or 15 years ago. I didn't think, you know, that I had to also have something for your average Joe and Jane off the streets. And I love that. Was that just years of doing the teaching and watching the student and looking at how the audience was different and how they related to the material, you know?
That hit me. No, that was actually an epiphany, because my first few years, I just came back to the States from Germany. I was training 6 hours a day, 5 days a week. And I was and like everyone who learns at my school has to be like, you know, I was all kind of piss and vinegar at that time. And then I had a student come to me after about 2 years and said, hey, you know, I just want to let you know, like, coming to your school has been like a lifelong dream because I could never do martial arts as a child. And I grew up in kind of a somewhat abusive home, and training with you gave me the confidence to leave a really bad relationship in my life. And that was a moment where I was like, the idea that anyone would come to me for any other reason other than learning Wing Chun and trying to defend themselves or fight or whatever, for something like that. And I was like, oh, thank you. And then I thought about it and I was like, I realized maybe I sometimes put too much pressure on some of the junior students to perform at a super, super high level when in reality, they're coming to my school because it's a third place. And maybe I need to foster that idea a little bit more. And, you know, for people who don't know, the third place is you have work, home, and then there's always a other third place you go. And for a lot of people in the city, that third place is the bar or the pub after work. Yeah. For some people, it's a gym. Or for some people, it's something a lot more destructive. So if you have a school that becomes a community, it becomes the third place. It becomes the place people want to spend time. And that slowly came over time, that idea. It was a little more difficult when I was in Leung Ting's association because he was very much like, oh, you have to make sure all the students are, you know, at this level and really, really good and stuff like that. And so I had a little external pressure from my association to perform, which was fine. But when I became independent, I realized the hardcore types will always be your hardcore types. You can always service them. You can always give them what they want. But can you actually help the underserved person, which is not the person who's not hardcore, the person who's not, you know, super motivated and they're not getting up at 6 a.m. and training every day because they don't need Wing Chun any less than anyone else. And the hardcore types, they don't really even need Wing Chun. They want it. But the person who's not hardcore needs it. And, right. and so that's a different thing. And that took me some time to realize, I'm pretty sure if there was anyone who knew me 15 years ago and they would listen to me talk now, they'd be like, oh man, you've changed quite a bit. And I'm fine with that, because I think if you are not constantly examining the way you think about things, the way you look at things, if you don't look at a past version of yourself with a tiny bit of cringe, I don't think you're taking the project of being a human being very seriously. Mm. Yeah.
Yep.
Well said. Jesus. I almost wish we were live. Sorry, Owen. I just almost wish we were live. That was so good. Go ahead, Owen.
No, I was going to ask, you know, what percentage of your total student base would you sort of put into your hardcore category? Like the more.
That's a great question. I would say 5%.
Okay.
Maybe. Yeah, that's cool. It depends on it. COVID skewed everything, because obviously we all lost a lot of students during COVID. So I would say my percentage of hardcores now is a little bit higher than normal, but let's say pre-COVID, when we're doing like our, you know, big numbers, if you have 100 students, you got like 5 that are just like solid, right? Maybe 8 who are really, really solid. That doesn't mean you don't have guys who can't fight, but I mean people who got the whole thing and really into the whole thing, right? Yep. But now I think because after COVID, we're rebuilding. So now we have more hardcore types than we did. It reminds me a little bit more of the early years as we were building up these days. So yeah, but it's certainly not a majority percent. And I think most Kung Fu instructors visualize their school with people who are like, you know, all super duper into it. And I recently had a Bagua guy. Well, recently, I'm going to say last year. Contact me and said, hey, like, I see you have a professional school and, can I invite you to lunch? I need some tips, because he was trying to get a little Bagua class or something going on in New York, and he wanted to have some tips because I guess it wasn't really working. And when I told him, like, you know, do you visualize that all the students who come to your school are just as dedicated and hardcore as you? And he's like, yeah, I mean, those are the people I want to go for. I go, then you'll never. I mean, if your goal is to earn even a little bit of money or at least pay for your rent, you'll never do it, because that's not the majority of people out there. It's the old trope, you know, how long does it take the average person to become a black belt? The average person does not become a black belt. Right. That's something to remind you of, like, how long does it take the average person to become a fully qualified Wing Chun instructor? Well, the average person does not become a fully qualified Wing Chun instructor. So you keep that in mind, and you realize, not to get too philosophical, but someone that Bruce Lee was very fond of, I'm also very fond of, I think he was one of the most brilliant minds of the 20th century, Jiddu Krishnamurti. He always said, the instructor, the teacher, imposes his burden on the disciple. And so you are, you know, it's almost like the parent that is living vicariously through the child is doing dance and gymnastics, not because the child loves it, but because the parents want them to do it because they didn't do it, or maybe they didn't do it quite to the right level. And tell me that martial art instructors aren't kind of mostly on that same kind of kick, right? And if you release that burden and you just let them come and enjoy it, and if their technique is not perfect or they're not doing everything perfect, why do instructors get bent out of shape? Because they think they're being judged by other martial art instructors. And they go like, oh, well, if another colleague of mine saw my team doing this crappy bong style, it's going to look at me weird. But you are not responsible for that other Wing Chun instructor. What that other Wing Chun instructor says doesn't matter at all. You are responsible for the people who come and trust you and give you money and come in the door. And if you take that seriously, you give no flying F's about what your colleagues say, because you still got a row of bangers, your hardcore guys. Will always be judged by your hardcore guys. is Yip Man judged by the hundreds and hundreds of students who didn't become anything in Wing Chun? No, you look at Leung Ting and Choi Chun Tin and Lok Yu and Leung Ting and William Cheung and what, you know, Wong So, all of the, those are the guys you look at. It's 7 to 10 guys. He taught for 22 years. Okay. Wow. So there are a lot of people who did not make that list. Are we judging Yip Man posthumously on, Tan Yok, who learned from 1957 to 1961 and didn't do jack squat in Wing Chun? No. But that guy maybe really enjoyed his training there and always had fond memories of learning from Yip Man for all those years. But you look at Yip Man as the guy who produced Wong So Man, Bruce Lee, Cha Sheng Tin, Leung Teng, Hua Kan Ming, you know, Wong Q, all of these guys. You don't look at him as the guy who produced Ng Chan Yuk, who, you know, is an accountant and never learned beyond the Chum Q. But he's like, yeah, I learned from Yip Man. It was a lot of fun. I probably should have stuck around with it. I didn't know he's going to be famous, right? So why do we impose these burdens on ourselves based on a completely constructed idea of what we think our so-called colleagues are going to look at us at when we are responsible to the people who come in the door? This is why I really don't care much about the general Wing Chun community. And I know I say that on the podcast, people get a little, they think it's a little harsh. But the thing is that I respect the opinions of individuals, of friends, of people that I think they're doing something well. The Wing Chun community as a whole is a heaping dumpster fire. Why would I care? Absolutely. With the community in the whole, they cannot even get it together with themselves. Why do I care what their collective opinion is about anything that I do or my teacher or my own students? It's, you would have to pay me some cash to care about what some of even these internet, these guys on YouTube, they're, you know, like watching videos of other people's wings. It's like, I know it works for the algorithm. I know this is what people want, but the thing is that these are just noisemakers, and these guys only exist in your head if you let them. All right. Your students are your responsibility. Your own skills are yours. And ultimately how you come out of this happy and fulfilled is the only thing that matters. And by being a slave to other people's opinions, you will only be miserable. And the collective opinion of most Wing Chun people is worth nothing. I'm sorry. It's really, I value the opinion of my BJJ and boxing friends far higher than most of the Wing Chun community. I mean, who cares about these people? These are children. All right. With microphones.
That's actually the first run of our show. We were actually thinking about naming Kung Fu Conversations Children with Microphones, but I think Kung Fu Conversations is a far better topic and well said.
Yes. And I don't mean to go, but I when I say that about the general Kung Fu community and opinions, I also mean that of mine. If I say something on my podcast that another Wing Chun Sifu doesn't agree with or doesn't like, I would implore them to not care. Okay. Because it's just my opinion. You know what I mean? Like the same way, it's like the same way I look at them and I go, okay, it's interesting. I can listen to it. But the mark of an educated person is to be able to understand an opinion and articulate an opinion without necessarily having to agree with it. And right. That goes for my own. If anything I say makes some people from other lineages feel maybe personally attacked, even if it's not my intention, I would implore them to not give a shit what the KFG has to say. It also doesn't matter. You in the Wing Chun community out there, for everything I just said about it, also don't need to care about what I say. You can also just put it aside, do your own thing, and not care if I said something about Bong Sao that you think makes you upset. All right. I don't be upset about it. It's just my take, and my take is not any more important than anyone else's.